Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Welcome to the Pitchfork Review. I'm Pooja Patel, the editor of Pitchfork. It's our last episode of the season, and I can say with total sincerity that it has been an insane ride trying to figure out how to do a music podcast over Zoom during a pandemic. So thank you for bearing with us through all of that. We wanted to take a break from our usual year-end lists of best songs, albums, and artists, and instead, we thought we'd bring on a news editor and a reviews editor to talk about some of the best and worst things that happened in music this year. I'm joined today by Pitchfork Associate Editor Anna Gatza and news editor Matt Strauss. Hello.
Hi.
Hey.
So the site just wrapped up this huge task of pulling together a bunch of different roundups of our favorite music of the year. And within that process, there's definitely a lot of kind of kooky superlatives that jokingly get bandied about by staff. So today we're going to try to run through some of the best and worst that just didn't fit anywhere else, some of which feel extremely specific to 2020.
Well, truthfully, I want to take some credit here because I think the seed of this idea started in my notes app where I write everything that I write for Pitchfork on my iPhone notes. I was just riffing on some of my least favorite things that happened this year, some of which were a little too spicy to make it on the podcast. And it's, you know, my great honor to be joined by Matt Strauss, who's just known for his incredibly dry sense of humor that he shares with us in our daily morning meetings. Riffing on the news in a deadpan, so dead that I can't believe he's here with us today.
Yeah, I had to. I'm on 20 Adderalls right now just to stay awake.
It is true that of the staff, we have probably our biggest cynic, i.e. the person who keeps a list of the worst things that happened in music this year on her iPhone notepad just because. And the like dad joke of all dad jokes, Matthew Strauss. I mean that in the most endearing of ways.
Thank you. You know, as Anna alluded to, I typically brief the staff every morning on news that has happened or news that is to come. And you see a lot in this job. So there are some days where you just want to...
We've seen a lot. We've seen too much. We've seen too much and we're here to share it.
So I'm going to run through some categories and each of you will share your pick for the best or the worst instance of it from this year. But no one knows each other's answers, which I'm sure is going to be very fun for all of us. Let's start with the best and worst songs about the coronavirus. Truly a nightmare prompt to begin with. Anna, what is the best?
This is really a personal choice for me, but it's maybe the only song about coronavirus that I sincerely like to listen to, which is Coffee's Lockdown, because it doesn't remind me about coronavirus. You know, it's just a really cute song. It has a great hook. Where will we go? When the quarantine thing done and everybody does. It also speaks to how I actually feel, which is like, I'm lonely and I miss getting to plan trips and to go places. And that's what the song is about. Like, it's not about being in lockdown. It's a flirt. It's like, can I put you on lockdown? Like, where are we going to go? Where are we going to go on vacation once we get to travel again? It doesn't belabor the coronavirus point. It's really focused on what comes next, which is what we all need more of. Thanks.
Yeah, I would argue that is the only good coronavirus themed song, which makes Matt's category much harder. Matt, what is the worst?
So I had a couple. And then I also thought I could opt out by kind of saying the obvious, which is they're all really bad.
They're all terrible.
I mean, I don't need to belabor the point, but like the amount of loss experienced this year is immense. And like somebody making a joke out of it is callous, to say the least. And perhaps the most callous goes to that guy, I hardly even know how to say his name, but DJ I Marquise, who mashes up various things.
He famously of that song, Lose Your Job.
Yeah, famous for his Lose Your Job song. Very early on in the pandemic, he remixed, and that is even a generous way of putting it, he remixed Cardi B Instagram video where she was saying coronavirus.
Coronavirus! I'm telling you, it's real!
I mean, musically, it's not really... I'm struggling to come up with the word because it's not really a song. It sounds like a lot of presets. Like, I don't know if this guy's ever heard a song or he's just like going on GarageBand and kind of clicking around whatever beats he can make.
I totally forgot about this.
It was really the first phenomenon. And I just found it so insulting in so many ways because it was also like all of this was so fresh for everyone. And like the hospitals were jammed. People didn't know what to do, how long we'd be inside. Mm-hmm. And he just like, it's basically like SEO in song form. And it sounds terrible. It's just insulting in every possible way. So yeah, I really hate that song. And like when I was coming up with what I should say for this prompt, I couldn't make it more than 30 seconds in. But even then, you get the idea.
Can I share some fellow bad songs?
Please do.
Do you remember the 21 Pilots song, Level of Concern?
I do remember that one. You know, I gotta just hand it to the boys, though, in that regard, because I feel like...
What? Terrible. The line, the hook was, will you be my little quarantine? Wondering, would you be my little quarantine? Which doesn't even rhyme with Valentine, which I think was the...
Yeah, that's why we gotta hand it to the boys. Like, you just...
Jesus Christ.
You just gotta recognize when your audience is, like, really interested in the fact that you're stupid. And do it.
But it also climbed the charts. Like, people really liked the song, and it was terrible.
We should do a whole other round of awards for best and worst rhymes with quarantine. Everybody was really struggling on that.
Yeah. Another thing that 2020 brought us was people trying to figure out live music. And I would like your takes on the best and worst of the pandemic concert.
I have the best concert, the only good pandemic concert. It was the orchestra performance for The Plants. You remember this. In case you didn't remember, this was at the Gran Teatro del Liceu in Barcelona, in Spain. It was the Usely String Quartet, so only four people, safely socially distanced. They played Puccini's Cristitami. I just remember how it looked because it's this beautiful old gilded theater with multiple balcony levels. It's this like transformative experience that we've missed out on this year while we've all been mostly confined to our own neighborhoods. And seeing all the plants in the theater, they put a full-sized potted plant in every seat. They're sitting in these red velvet seats for this really dramatic like Christmas time aesthetic. And you can watch the live stream of this concert. It's on the Opera House's website. And they actually start the performance with a recorded announcement about, you know, please turn off your cell phones. Please don't make extra noise. And all the plants are just sitting there listening to it.
Benvinguts al Gran Teatre del Liceu.
It really makes me happy.
Anna, also resident plant mom of Pitchfork. Matt, what was the worst?
You know, it's hard to say because I don't know if there's actually been a lot of damage from this one, the way there's been damage from stuff like the Sturgis rally. But I think just as far as something being a real WTF moment, it was Picture Plane playing Free Secret Rave underneath the Kosciuszko Bridge. And apparently yes. Also DJ Mazurbate played.
Yes, the videos looked crazy.
In the Snapchat video, people could be seen dancing as a DJ worked behind a turntable. Only some of these revelers wore masks.
Yeah, and Picture Plane was like as contrite as you could be for someone who just DJed a rave, saying like, I didn't really expect this to happen. I think just what makes it the worst for me is like, you have to wonder why they booked Picture Plane. because he's not really relevant anymore. I think what makes it the worst concert is like, you don't need to go see Picture Plane in 2020, especially like against your better judgment or like making other people sick.
Sorry, I'm just dying at the idea of going to a Picture Plane rave. Like, what? Help. Like, no one went to see Picture Plane in 2012.
I can't see my family, but I can see Picture Plane, okay?
When we were readying ourselves for this episode and discussing this topic, kind of the obvious one was the Chainsmokers concert in the Hamptons that they actually paid a fine for.
Saturday's drive-in show in Watermill was headlined by the Chainsmokers, the EDM duo.
But much like 21 Pilots, like, you kind of got to expect it. You know what they're still relevant. You're doing it because they're the Chainsmokers and you like to give the old middle finger to the man, but still enjoy your job in some sort of financial sector. But I just can't really imagine who considers themselves enough of a renegade to go to the Picture Plane show underneath the Kosciuszko Bridge.
And it was like the 180 on it too, where he like recanted and apologized the very next morning. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They told me that this one would be super safe and that masks and sanitizer and water would be provided to everyone who entered.
The next category up is the best and worst political songs of the year. And I have no idea what you guys have picked, but obviously political can span the realm of the election, the hellish election, the Black Lives Matter movement, social justice, anything at all.
Best political song, tough category to do right. You have to make it look easy, but it's really hard. And Iris Demence going down to sing in Texas just has it all.
I'm going down to sing in Texas where anybody can carry a gun. But we will all be so much safer there, the biggest lie under the sun.
I'm not somebody who listens to a lot of country and roots music, but this song truly blew me away, like almost moves me to tears. It's 9 minutes long because she just covers everything, just like gun policy, wealth inequality. George W. Bush is a war criminal and it's embarrassing that celebrities are friends with him. Jesus served the poor, justice for Palestine, Black Lives Matter. She puts it all in there and her writing is so sharp. Her performance is really moving. It's just an incredible show of solidarity. Highest recommendation for that song.
Strauss, what's yours?
So my worst song, and it might just be the worst song of the year, somehow worse than DJ iMarquee's Coronavirus, is by Mr. Phineas O'Connell, aka Phineas, possibly just best known as Billie Eilish's brother. He released it on the day where they called the election for Biden, and it's called Where the Poison Is, and it's basically like an F you to Donald Trump.
No, my friends, guess it's on the president.
And I'm curious if he was going to still release it if Trump won. And the lyrics are just horrible. The chorus includes him saying there's a snake that thinks it's the president.
There's a snake that thinks it's the president.
And then in the second verse, he's basically like outlining society's ills.
Once we put this all behind us, we get to go right back to school shootings and a climate crisis.
I was extremely surprised at the second verse, as well as the outro, where it's kind of like a little slinkier. And he says, I guess not everybody knows the emperor was never wearing any clothes.
The emperor was never wearing any clothes.
So there's kind of a little treat along the way.
Well, I really like gossip and beef. So we've entered the beefing section of our best worst list. Let's begin with, what was the best lawsuit of 2020? And what was the worst? And I'm going to let you guys explain what best and worst means in the context of, you know, legal troubles or trauma.
I can kick this off with the absolute best lawsuit I've ever seen. As part of my job as the news editor, I end up going through a lot of legal documents. And most of them are really, really boring, just entirely procedural. But every once in a while, there's something that you can actually understand. And it's incredible to read and go through everything that's being alleged. And you just want it all to be true. And you want to keep reading more and more. So Pat Corcoran, better known as Pat the Manager, sued his former client, Chance the Rapper. What makes this lawsuit so good for me is I lived through it. and it's extremely validating. Like, we covered Chance extremely closely for the last few years until basically what Pat is alleging. So we would just do a lot of news stories. You know, this guy's got a feature on a song, this guy's on TV, et cetera, et cetera. He's a real superstar. And then he drops the absolute worst album in The Big Day, which is his debut album.
I can't believe it. Must be the luckiest night alive.
And it's about getting married. So basically, Pat says Chance didn't try at all on that album and was just freestyling it a lot of the time and had a lot of hangers-on in the studio.
Oh my God, it is the greatest day of my life.
And that when he announced the release date, he was basically like, you haven't even started this, like, don't announce this. But Chance did it anyway. And it was funny to check our news story about it. There's like a 45-minute gap between when Chance says, big day coming in February, and when Pat says it. And I just like to imagine Pat like hopped on the phone with him and he's like, hey man, you know, we go back a long way. Do you think you could delete that tweet? So basically, album flopped. He says, nobody likes it. It sold terribly. He had to cancel his tour because nobody was going to go to it. And then Pat ultimately got fired.
Matt, can you explain that lawsuit for us? What is he suing him for?
Yeah, the boring part of it is that Pat, the manager, claims he's owed commission on Chance's streaming royalties, his album sales, his touring income, and some of the other revenues through a certain number of years. And Chance, as it's alleged in the lawsuit, has apparently withheld that.
Got it.
The real meat of it is that it really leaves the door open for anybody who makes a terrible album to get sued. I think that's really what we could all look forward to. So like, if anybody is listening and happened to work on, let's just say, like, Jesus is King, and, you know, feels they're short $15 or something, I say just sue. Sue them and say, nobody liked it. You owe me my money.
I find it refreshing to see someone admit that a tour was canceled because the album flopped.
Right, yeah.
A lot of times you hear that on hearsay and they'll say, oh, we had a scheduling conflict. We're going to postpone it until after the next album. And it's nice to see that fig leaf removed in this case.
Yeah, well, it should also be clarified. Chance never admitted that. He said it was to spend time with his daughter and wife.
What is the worst lawsuit, Anna? I feel like all of these can be best and worst. You know,
my pick for worst lawsuit is a little bit the opposite of the Chance versus Pat lawsuit, because it is just procedural. Like, the facts of this case are so divorced from like how I would call it, how it is on the ground. And it is Lady A, the band, formerly Lady Antebellum, suing Lady A, the blues singer, aka Anita White. So you remember this story. Lady Antebellum decided that their name was offensive, decided a little bit belatedly that their name was offensive, and changed it to Lady A, and accidentally stole the name of this existing musician who went by Lady A. And they've had sort of a contested relationship that devolved into, ironically, the band suing the individual musician. And if you read the fine print of the lawsuit itself, it's like, not actually that bad. They're not asking her for money. They're not asking her to give up her name. They're just trying to like establish their own copyright claims on the same terms. But the optics of it just could not be worse of this like white band who realized that their name was like racially offensive. So they took this black performer's name and now they're kind of using the legal system to double down and enforce that choice. I think it's just really just the opposite of classy, especially in a year when lesser known artists are struggling and can't perform live. This whole fight like has destroyed Lady A, the blues singer's SEO. So she's now suing them for money and damages, which I think we'll probably not see that resolve until sometime next year. But a low point for me.
And one of the funniest elements, or like one of the funniest problematic elements also at the forefront of this, is that Lady Antebellum changing their name to Lady A just means that the A still stands for Antebellum. Like, it's not solving the issue of removing the word antebellum. It has very specific history and connotation to it. It's not solving that problem. It's just abbreviating it to the letter A.
A real lack of creative thinking here, and like a real lack of like awareness of how their actions will come across to the world. They've really brought a lot of like a bad look down on themselves.
Let's move to a tangential category, which is music beefs. What were the best and worst music beefs from this year?
I've got a best beef for you. This is a sincere best beef. I think we all learned a lot from No Name and J. Cole getting into it earlier this year. You know, a lot of beefs are just ego trips, but this was a beef with substance to it. You know, this summer, as Black Lives Matter was getting more visible, No Name posted a tweet that was not naming any names, just suggesting that some artists who talk about social issues in their music could maybe show up in other ways too. And evidently J. Cole saw this and thought it was about him and wrote an entire song that was an attempt to critique himself and like acknowledge her point, but he really put his foot in his mouth when he instead objected to her tone.
She mad at the celebrities, low key I be thinking she talking about me. Now I ain't no dummy to think I'm above criticism, so when I see something that's valid, I listen, but shit, it's something about the queen's tone that's bothering me.
Didn't go over as well as he thought, I don't think, at least outside of J. Cole's own fans, did not go over real well. But No Name responded with song 33, where she really kind of tried to redirect the effort back to her point that she was actually making and, you know, say, hey, like, this is about you, but it isn't really about you. The point I'm making is that it is not about you.
One girl missing another, but niggas in the back, quiet as a church mouse. Basement studio when duty calls to get the verse out. I guess the ego hurt now. It's time to go to work. Wow, look at him go. He really doubts to write about me when the world is in smokes, when it's people in trees, when George was begging for his mother saying he couldn't breathe. He thought to write about me. One girl missing, another one go missing.
And subsequently, even after that, she stepped up and kind of apologized for even getting into it with him and for responding with us, you know, responding in kind, because she felt like it was a distraction from, you know, the actual like social justice issues that she cares about. But I really respect how No Name has like modeled accountability and like learning in real time on Twitter. Like so few public figures are capable of doing that in any capacity at all. And like, right. She really showed us how it's done and continues to do so.
I'm with you. Give us a worst beef.
This one's a little more ambiguous, but if you'll indulge me.
We always indulge you.
Yeah, I get indulged quite often. I think we could broadly call this Van Morrison versus the people, which he, for whatever reason, like, decided he's an anti-masker, etc. And he released some sort of anti-lockdown song.
No more lockdown. No more lockdown.
And it came with a lot of fanfare, as is the case with like white male rockers in the headlines. Like they'll get the headlines, unfortunately. And then like no one actually listened to the song or cared about it, and it kind of stunk, and it was hardly even about coronavirus, which is why it didn't even qualify for the earlier category.
What was the name of the song?
Here's the thing. There's actually more than one. Van Morrison has so far released a song called Born to Be Free, and then he's released one called As I Walked Out, but I don't really know what he's walking from or where or out. And the one I'm actually talking about is called No More Lockdown. Mm-hmm. And the only lyric I wrote down from this song is, quote, pretending it's for our safety when it's really to enslave.
Pretending it's for our safety when it's really to enslave.
Oh my God.
So this is more of a Cold War type beef of just him doing his best to radicalize people who, if his fans are his age, should be wearing masks. No one even got that upset about it. No one listened to it.
Christ.
But he's doing his best to try to infect at least one or two other folks. Whether or not we hand it to him is up to him.
Moving on to a less controversial topic. Big year for cover songs. What are your picks for the best and worst cover songs of the year?
My favorite cover songs this year, if I'm remembering them correctly, I think came from Bill Callahan and Bonnie Prince Billy. Sometime around the summer, they just started releasing cover song once a week with different artists and collaborators, usually Drag City collaborators. They had some less good ones, such as covering Billie Eilish's I Wish You Were Gay.
I just kind of wish you were gay.
And they had some really cool ones, like they covered Steely Dan's Deacon Blues. And my favorite one is a cover they did with Matt Sweeney of Chavez. They covered Hank Williams Jr.'s OD'd in Denver.
She treated me nice, and I'd like to find her again. But I OD'd in Denver, and I just can't remember her name.
to take listeners behind the scenes, I live outside of Denver. So it's cool to hear Denver in a song, even in a really negative light.
Just like to be recognized.
Yeah, it's good to be recognized. You don't hear a lot of songs by LCD Sound System called I Love You, Denver, But You're Bringing Me Down.
Denver is just happy to be here.
Yes. Regardless of my locale, I think a lot of people would agree that a good cover song is one that feels pretty distinct from the original. And it's just so completely different. It's really dark, creepy. It's just a really alluring song. Whereas Hank Williams Jr.'s original is like a real country knee slapper.
She treated me nice and I'd like to find her again. But I OD'd in Denver and I just can't remember her name.
And he's just like, well, I don't really know what's going on because I got too high. So they really take a look at the dark side of that.
I brought it on myself, so I guess I shouldn't complain. Doc says, son, you can't do any more of that cocaine.
That was just one that I really liked listening to in Denver.
That was a delightful thing. It was really nice to see those pop up.
Yeah, and I feel like I don't know why they would choose the people they'd choose, but it was kind of nice to just see them pull in these like 2000s indie figures for a little shine.
Yeah. Anna, what's the worst?
First, I have a competing best, which is Bedouin, Hooray for the Riff Raff, and Waxahachie covering Big Star's 13.
And I'll shake.
Oh, yes, it's so good.
A great song and like a real just killer lineup. But I'm here to talk about the worst cover song, which is, I mean, I'll be honest, it's a little bit of a personal beef, but something that really I did not enjoy was G-Eazy covering Lazarus by David Bowie.
Look up here, I'm in heaven. I've got scars.
To start with, you have G-Eazy, sort of like a mediocre rapper, in this case, getting into singing, which is always an iffy prospect to start with. And then you have Lazarus, the song, which is, you know, really famous because it's the single from David Bowie's album that he recorded as he was dying of cancer.
By the time I got to New York, I was living like a...
It has this really heavy emotional weight behind it. And I think it just doesn't carry over in the cover version at all. The songwriting in a Bowie song is going to be so much stronger than any G-Eazy song. And so the mismatch of like talent to caliber of material is really apparent. He has this really heavy vocal filtering on the whole time, like maybe because he's not the strongest singer. And then the song itself, it sounds like a reference track with just like a bunch of reverb on it. And I just find it insipid.
I need to point out that Matt Strauss has donned his G-Eazy baseball cap.
Matt Strauss is trolling me in the chat wearing a G-Eazy snapback.
It's fitted.
It's fitted.
It says G-Eazy on the back.
I can't believe that you just had that on hand. Like it was just sitting next to you. Is it something you wear often?
He did not know that I was going to talk about this.
I do wear it often. It's been, for anybody who can't visualize
Christ.
It, it's a basically an Oakland Athletics hat, but instead of an A's logo, it's an old English G and it says Easy on the back. And when I bought it off Grails, the guy was like, man, I'm so disappointed. Like,
you paid money for this?
I got it for like less than half of what G-Eazy sells it for.
You are really revealing so much of your personality on this episode.
I am. And the guy was disappointed. He had to even sell it to me. It just didn't fit him. But
how much did you spend on that hat?
I spent $20.
Unbelievable. So the next category is an extremely 2020 category. And that is the best and worst TikTok dances or challenges. We are going to call on our resident TikTok expert, Kat Zhang, for that one.
Hello. I am so honored to be called in as, you know, the token youth. Although I saw this tweet that said, once you turn 23, that's it. No more life, no more youth, death. So I think you kind of have to enlist someone else to take this role because I'm already done with.
Okay, well then the rest of us are zombies.
I do spend a lot of time on TikTok. There are a lot of horrific things there. However, nothing is more horrific to me than Jason Derulo's presence. I hated Jason Derulo from the start of his career. I think he did nothing to the song Hide and Seek. And then he released a series of singles where he tried to cram in like the woodwind section, but like make all of his songs really sexual. So it'd be like in his song Wiggle, it would be like wiggle, wiggle, wiggle. And then there would be like a toy flute sound.
You know what to do with that big fat butt. Wiggle, wiggle, wiggle.
I feel like just listening to all those songs made sex seem so unappealing for whatever years he was on the charts. Jason Derulo is the like top artist on TikTok and has like the top TikTok song according to TikTok's like kind of end of year report. And the song is called Savage Love (parentheses) Laxed Siren Beat. So basically what happened is there was like a New Zealand teenager made a beat that I think is like reflective of Polynesian culture. That was part of a trend where you like show off kind of your native culture and, you know, maybe you wear your traditional dress. Although quickly it, you know, it turned into more sexual dancing. Jason Derulo stole the beat initially without crediting the original producer. And then he just turned it into like a very boring song about like love and whatever else.
Savage love. When you kiss me, I know you don't get two fucks, but I still want that. Your savage love. Your savage love.
When Jason Derulo puts the word savage in a song where he stole the beat off of someone who is like talking about like their specific heritage, there's like a weird kind of colonial or whatever vibe to me. It was just kind of weird, felt a little insensitive. The song is horrible. Just another strike in the book for Jason Derulo.
Well, there was plenty of actually good things that happened on TikTok this year, as many of us learned about in your column, The TikTok Report. Tell us what your favorite thing to happen in music on TikTok was.
I'm not sure I have like a favorite thing, but one thing that I found really compelling this year were glitchcore TikToks. Generally, something interesting about TikTok is that it like gives fans or listeners sometimes like more kind of agency because they can create their own interpretation to a song. And I feel like glitchcore edits were kind of big proof of that. So to ground this like more specifically in an example, there is this hyper pop song called Never Met, a kind of saccharine song about breaking up with someone over like Nintendo DS chat that went viral on TikTok.
I wish we never met. We broke up on pizza chat, crying on my DS. Coming to a birthday party for one of your friends. But now that this is over, I can hate them. I don't have to pretend.
People started making these really cool, zany, rainbow colored kind of music videos to them where they would change like the color of their faces as if they were like chameleons or something. And then more complicated glitchcore edits would involve like cartoons and a lot of like pixelation and like just making the very normal environment of like a bedroom turn into like a sort of trippy scene. And so after that example, I kind of discovered like this whole community of glitchcore editors who often take songs that aren't like very popular and then kind of make videos to them and add their own like custom like designs, and then they help the songs like blow up because people are, I guess, are really compelled by their vision and like their kind of influence as tastemakers. So that's pretty cool. I think also to think about TikTok as a place where like smaller sub-communities can thrive and they can kind of promote music within their own space without always having to like filter through like the more mainstream side of TikTok.
Well, Kat, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more superlatives from the year in music.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the Pitchfork Review. We're talking about some of the highest highs and lowest lows from the year in music, discussing superlatives with Pitchfork's associate editor, Anna Gatza, and news editor, Matt Strauss. So I would love to talk about the best and worst musical collaborations this year. Matt, what's yours?
I kind of have a lot all wrapped into one. I think broadly, I would say my favorite and most unexpected pairing this year has been Taylor Swift and Aaron Dessner. She secretly worked with him, and they, along with Jack Antonoff, made Folklore, which is a great album, and it just showed this new side to Taylor Swift, new old side to Taylor Swift, where she went back to her folksier roots.
Please picture me in the trees. I hid my peak at 7.
And also just brought along some of Aaron Dessner's tendencies with Big Red Machine and The National, more piano and these muted but really emotional arrangements.
My only one, my smoking gun, my eclipsed sun, this has broken me.
And then she surprised us again by releasing Evermore, which she made because she said she just couldn't stop working in folklore land.
The more that you say, the less I know. Wherever you stray, I follow. I'm begging for you to take my hand, wreck my plans, that's my man.
Evermore has even more Aaron Dessner. Folklore, she kind of splits time working with longtime collaborator Jack Antonoff. But here, Jack has one song with Taylor and then one co-write with Taylor and Aaron Dessner. So it's pretty incredible to see her just lean even more into that kind of magical, almost pop combination they have. Like everything feels pretty and it's coming from like another part of her that she's not really accessed in the last few years. The way that Aaron's role is almost to open up Taylor and just let her go down, you know, these passion roads. They don't bring too much of their seriousness. They don't bring too much of their lightness. I think they meet somewhere in the middle and make something that sounds like if Taylor Swift had been fronting The National for the last 20 years.
You know, I have a lot of bests. I think there were a couple of very huge, clear bests of the year. Obviously, we had Megan Cardi on WAP. We had Ariana and Gaga on Rain On Me. We had City Girls and Doja Cat with Pussy Talk. But there's one song that I can't really decide if it's a best or a worst, and it straddles the line for me. And that involves Mulatto, who is also featured in the video for WAP, actually. But her song Muwop very heavily relies on the Gucci Mane song Freaky Girl.
Very freaky girl. Get it from my mama. I'm not with the game. I'm without a drama. Make them give me brain in the front seat of the Hummer. Make them give me brain in the front seat of the Hummer.
The song was a huge hit this year. I mean, it was everywhere. But also, I think what's kind of frustrating about that song is that it feels so familiar and it's really fun and catchy, but 1,000,000,000% derivative and fully reliant on something that already exists in a better form.
I kind of love that. Like, Gucci Mane is really generous with the features. Like, he's always got a feature on everybody's album. He's on Rico Nasty's album. And it's like, he's just always victory lapping.
But it's his, like, that song exists already. And it's very famous. And people love it.
He probably gets royalties on his own song. That's double dipping.
Yeah. Big win for him. Again, it's one of those things that is both the best and the worst. Okay, on to the next category. Something that I think is, I'm using the phrase near and dear very, very loosely to all of our damaged brains, which is the best and worst music person on, I'm going to say, social media. I think we all have people that we hate follow on many platforms. So whoever wants to go first, I hand it over to you.
I don't hate follow. I'm too wholesome. I have a best music person on Twitter, or at least a person whose tweets I always enjoy seeing, which is Perfume Genius. We love him.
Yeah.
I feel like his tweets always hit the right tone. He'll post like an animal picture, but it's never one you've seen before. It's always like a really obscure, maybe even a species of animal you didn't know was cute. And like whatever he says is always exactly what I didn't know that I wanted to see. So yeah, follow Perfume Genius on Twitter.
Yeah, he's pretty incredible. I feel like I saw him tweet something about chairs recently I was really moved by, which is also kind of part of his thing, is that everything he shares is extremely emotional in like as Anna said, in an unexpected way.
Yeah.
Yeah, got a strong memory hit of these chairs I happened upon 7 years ago and frantically searched my phone for the pictures. And it's these two antique chairs in an empty parking lot. I was listening to this song and had waking for a long time. I cried so hard at these chairs. Shout out these chairs.
Shout out these chairs.
And the song is I Believe in You from Talk Talk's Spirit of Eden.
Oh, so nice.
Yeah.
Do you guys know about his obsession with rats?
Yes.
Yeah. And sharing his rat finds on social media. When I interviewed him earlier this year, I directly asked him, like, where do your rats come from? And he said, you know, I just Google sad, lonely rats and then search Google images for like 15 pages until I find the one. So if you're wondering how he gets his great Twitter content.
My other Twitter pick, because I feel like this category deserves two bests, and we don't need to slam on anyone's Twitter, there's enough bad accounts out there, is Riley Walker. Consistently makes me laugh out loud, but he's also really honest and vulnerable, which kind of seals it. Like, just one from a couple days ago, Harold Budd died, and Riley Walker eulogized him by tweeting, I ate a sandwich next to Harold Budd in catering at a festival and with a mouthful of turkey said, I love falling asleep to your records. It's so nice. And he replied, you look like you haven't slept in weeks. Rest in peace.
I was just going to ask you to read that exact tweet because that really sent me when I saw it.
I think the peak Riley Walker tweet of 2020 might be Tenet sucks. Worst Nolan movie. Also had entire theater to myself in Connecticut and thought it'd be a good and thought it would be a good self bit to loudly fart and ended up shitting myself. Sorry to the kid getting paid $8 an hour. Who was gonna find Hanes briefs in the trash? Folks, just stay home and watch the movie on Disney Plus. I mean, Riley's a very funny guy, and he's a great musician.
He
self-released a record called For Michael Rips, and it's with J.R. Bohannon and Ben Greenberg. It's just like 40 minutes of like experimental guitar noodling. And from that mind comes a self bit where he shits himself.
He's great on Twitter. But one small joy I have is that I recently discovered mid-pandemic while we were in like the dead heat of it, where everyone was at their most depressed, that Riley and I both follow the New York City Department of Transportation parking alerts on Twitter.
That's good.
And I found that out because every morning they will tweet like parking rules are in effect or parking rules have been suspended today or whatever. And during one of their daily parking rules are in effect tweets during the dead heat of COVID. So Riley Walker responded to them and said, hey, suck it. Like he was really annoyed and replied to the thought on Twitter.
Riley Walker said, we will not be moving our cars today.
He's got several winners this year. after Guitar Center went bankrupt, he said, "I'm banned from Guitar Center in Rockford, Illinois for kicking and breaking the humidifier in the acoustic room while I was tripping on 2CI. Now I will dance on its ashes and salt the earth below it." So there's that vulnerability too. He's not above, you know, expressing some darkness to get to the punchline.
You know, I just thought of one more, a late contender for the crown, because she didn't tweet as herself until about the beginning of November. But that is iconic pop soul singer Dionne Warwick, who has had a Twitter account since 2012, apparently. But, you know, up until the last few weeks, it must have been run by her management. It was quite dry and, you know, lacking personality. Not anymore. So she's really broken out. She asked Chance the Rapper why he had the rapper in his name. A recent hit from her was, "I took the time to check out William Eyelash. Very spooky, great vocals at Billie Eilish." just great. Another one I like a lot, which, call me a conspiracist, I think she wrote this. "To the person who tweeted at Ms. Warwick asking for the PS5, she says no. -DW team." Yeah, I don't think she just turned her account back over to her team just for that one tweet. I think she was just denying responsibility. But she's fantastic, and she really, like, she really has her finger on her pulse, and on the pulse of Twitter, and she's always like speaking out for trans rights. And there's already a New York Times piece about her Twitter presence, and she also was parodied on SNL. That's how big of a hit this has been. So yeah, give it up for Dionne Warwick on Twitter.
Can I share it's not a music person, but my favorite social media music moment, the best music moment / song release on social media in 2020. That would be Whitmer Thomas's Big Baby, which I don't even know how to describe. Whitmer Thomas is this comedian / musician. Matt, is he a musician for real?
Yeah, I think he's a musician. It's very like post Bo Burnham, where he like makes his jokes via song.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
If you follow him on Instagram, it's mostly like he does all the filters, which is where we end up with Big Baby.
Mommy was a big, big baby. Daddy was a big baby too.
I personally love the "It's fun to be a baby because everything is free."
It's easy to be a baby. All you gotta
do is sing. Very rapid fire, do the worst things on social media.
I don't follow him, so I don't really know the extent of his tweet activity, but I think this one tweet alone might be the worst tweet of the year in of course the best way. And it's from Jack Harlow, the young Louisville rapper. And he tweeted, "Actresses, hard eyes emoji. I love their minds. See no evil monkey emoji. Or should I say girl actor, prayer hands emoji." And it's specifically like the really white prayer hands. Like he shifted the emoji tone and ends by saying respect. So if I were to say that without interrupting, it's "Actresses, I love their minds. Or should I say girl actor, respect." And frankly, respect.
Thank you, Jack, for that. Anna, do you have one?
This isn't best or worst. I just need to memorialize. Quote, "Never forget the Grammys. Didn't give me my Best New Artist award, but I had 7 songs simultaneously charting on Billboard and bigger first week than any female rapper in the last decade. Went on to inspire a generation. They gave it to the white man, Bon Iver. # Pink Friday" by Nicki Minaj.
Iconic tweet.
The white man, Bon Iver.
Honestly, also not wrong. They did give it to the white man, Bon Iver.
Not wrong. I don't know if anybody was looking. I don't know if anybody was looking for that take this year, but she's got it.
I do love that in that tweet, she is now delivered something new to the lexicon. The white man Bonnie Bear is gonna stay around for a while. All right, so given that this year was also an election year, we have a lot of best and worst contenders for the category of political moments in music. Who's gonna go first?
I can go first with a slew of favorite political moments, which, back when political rallies were held in person and when there were Democratic primaries, Bernie Sanders had countless musicians perform at his events, and he would almost always introduce them. And it was always great just hearing Bernie Sanders say band names. There's Soccer Mommy, Lucy Dacus. And then at an event in San Jose, he would like to thank the Joyce Manor Band.
Thank the Joyce Manor Band.
which was just very fun that he had to clarify that Joyce Manor, who are a pop punk band from Torrance, California, are in fact a band. Those were always pretty heartwarming. And then we plunged into lockdown.
And the Strokes were at his presidential...
That was huge.
Yeah, that was huge.
New Hampshire.
They played a song and were escorted off stage by police at a Bernie Sanders rally. What a time.
That's my personal winner for like best music in politics 2020.
Was it actually?
I think I just decided right now, like the Strokes getting the cops called on them at a Bernie rally. That's fantastic.
Well, also the irony of NYC cops being taken off of the Strokes' debut album because of 9/11. And then when they reemerge at the Bernie Sanders rally after a long time away, it's the cops that escort them off stage. Anna, what is your worst?
So I thought the worst might be billionaire presidential candidate Tom Steyer and Juvenile dancing to Back That Ass Up, which is extremely silly and dumb. Did not need to happen. But ultimately, I think it was sort of harmless and like at least Juvenile was in on it. So I'm going to have to go with the Donald Trump campaign constantly playing Fortunate Son by the Creedence Clearwater Revival at his rallies. We have all heard that song. It's, you know, a song that was written specifically against the draft and against like the Vietnam War and against the power establishment, like a song that goes out of its way to call out like plutocrats who don't pay taxes. And the Trump campaign choosing that as one of their signature rally songs is like so entitled, so ignorant, like it's just so stupid. It's confrontational. It really drives me crazy.
Surprised that Pete Buttigieg didn't come up in this at all.
Oh, God. The Pete Sands.
Okay, so the next superlative is the best and worst use of the 90s or aughts era music as nostalgia bait in a song from this year. You know, we're thinking of it as kind of a cheap ploy to use something that we all loved or remember from when we were kids and repurposing that to score extra points. I actually have one that I feel very strongly about, and it's not a song, but several songs by an artist. It's the artist who is the worst at nostalgia bait in the year 2020. And that artist is Rumor, spelled capital R-M-R. And he's this really over-stylized singer and rapper who wears a ski mask because he, quote unquote, wants people to hear with their ears and not with their eyes. And Rumor first appeared and went viral, I think it was in late February, with the song titled Rascal, which covers and kind of parodies a song called Bless the Broken Road that was written by the Nitty Gritty Band and then made really popular by the Rascal Flatts in 2000, hence Rascal as the title of the song. And the reason that the song became so popular is because it was also featured in a Hannah Montana movie. So that's some context for the song. And basically, he sings the melody of the Rascal Flatts cover while flipping the language to be about street hustling and drug culture.
And every sleepless night led me to where I am. Bitches that broke my heart, they became hoes that scared.
While that's kind of a cool idea, it feels really like it's all aesthetic for the sake of subversion. It's very deeply eye-rolly to me. It worked for many people. It was a huge viral success when it came out, though I wonder how much of that was kind of people really glomming onto the kitsch of it all. And then more recently, he put out this song called The Wishing Hour, which does the exact same bit, but with Matchbox 20's song, iconic song, actually, 3 a.m. To give an example of just kind of how cringy I find some of this parodying to be, he flips the hook, which I am sure everyone knows, and she says, baby, it's 3 a.m. and I must be lonely. And he says,
baby, it's 3 a.m. and I'm fucking horny.
I think that hits the nail on the head of just nostalgia gone way too wrong and way over the top this year. Anna, what about for you? Is there a best of the nostalgia realm?
one that I enjoy because I learned something is a record that Jeremy mentioned a couple of episodes ago when he was on, but the Bartee Strange album and the song Kelly Rowland.
Berlin City, where I saw the fantasies. Candy lip, I swear she tastes like tangerine.
The reason that song is titled Kelly Rowland is like not because it's about Kelly Rowland directly, I don't think, but because it uses that very familiar sample from Nelly and Kelly Rowland's song Dilemma. The
no matter what I do,
that little sound, which obviously everybody recognizes that sample because you know the song Dilemma, but hearing it on Kelly Rowland, the Bartee Strange song, got me to look it up. And our colleague Mac Perra actually sent me to this article titled This Sound is All Over Hip Hop Today and It Comes from an Unexpected Place. I wouldn't say it was that unexpected, but the place it comes from is not Kelly Rowland. I naively thought that that sound was Kelly Rowland singing. But the sound, as we know it, is actually a preset from the Roland MDC-1 synthesizer. Except here's the twist. The producer of Dilemma, the Nelly song, his name is Ryan Bowser. And in that article, he tells the journalist that he didn't use the preset. He says that he like created that sound organically himself and it just happened to come out sounding just like the synthesizer preset. I think that's really fascinating that he said it was like him singing it. And the article sort of poses this question.
Do we believe him?
I don't know. I don't know if I believe him. The article sort of poses this question of like, is this sound like inherently so appealing that you could be drawn to recreate it just like spontaneously? Or is it possible that he like doesn't want to say that he just used a synthesizer preset that everybody else uses because it's a very popular sample that's been used in like, you know, half a dozen well-known songs.
Was Dilemma the first of those songs?
I don't even think it was. I think it's just the best known one. And because that sample is such a like huge part of that beat, at least for me, like it's really locked in as the Dilemma sample, but it's not the Dilemma sample.
Wow. Incredible song. I can picture that music video in my head vividly right now. She's texting, saying, where are you at?
Oh, and it's in a text box, right?
Yeah. It's in a text in like an Excel spreadsheet or something. Well, thank you, Matt. And thank you, Anna, for coming on and sharing your encyclopedic knowledge of the year in music with us with all of these bests and worsts.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Pooja.
If you want to hear the songs that we talked about on this episode, check out our Spotify playlist. It's called The Pitchfork Review, Music from the Podcast. The Pitchfork Review is hosted by me, Pooja Patel. Thanks to Anna Gotza, Matt Strauss, and Kat Zhang for coming on the show. You can follow Anna on Twitter at @tweeasfuck, Matt at @MatthewStrauss_, and Kat at @KatZhang1. You can follow me on Twitter at @Sonari. You can follow Pitchfork on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at @Pitchfork. This episode was produced by Zachariah Hughes and Rufara Mazarura. It was edited by Andy Cush and Zachariah Hughes. Will Miller fact-checked the episode. Our original music is by Andrew Eben of Basement Crafts. This episode was mixed and scored by Mark Bush and Rufara Mazarura. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave us a review and subscribe to the podcast. You can also send an email to podcast@pitchfork.com with any feedback. Thanks for listening. This was our last episode of the season. We'll be back next year.